Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation outside the Cross Island, Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is December 15, 2016, or it is February 17, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled Sweet By and By. There's a long that is fair than day, and the faith we can see in afar. For the Father waits over the way to prepare us a dwelling place there in the sweet by and by. We shall meet on that beautiful shore in the sweet by and by. We shall meet on that beautiful shore. We shall sing on that beautiful shore the melodious songs of the blessed, and our spirit shall sorrow no more. Not a sigh for the blessing of rest. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on the beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on the beautiful shore. To a bountiful Father above, we will offer our tribute of praise for the glorious gift of His love and the blessings that hallow our day. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore.
Part 3, we're dealing with the Shepherd's Rod track. Okay, part 3 is on page 57 where we left off. We're going to try to make some headway today on it. It says that explain the cause or reason. Let's do a little review from our last study. Produce your cause, saith the Yahweh. Bring forth your strong reason, saith the King of Jacob. Okay. It says that let them bring them forth and show us what shall happen. Let them show the former things what they be, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them, or declare us things for to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that ye are gods, yea, do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and behold it together. Isaiah 41:21-23. Who hath wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, Yahweh, the first, and with the last, I am He. Isaiah 41:4. All right, that's where we ended our last study. Let's continue now. Explain the cause, the reason, the significance of the former things He demanded. Let us tell us, what do they mean? What are they for? Can you predict the future by the past, be it good or be it bad? Exhibit divine power if you can. Silence on the subject gives consent unto the fact that only the great I Am can thus forewarn the generations, the first to the last. And He makes it known that though the experiences through which our predecessors were permitted to pass were for our ensamples, Yet even these we of ourselves cannot correctly interpret. But now, at the appointed time, he himself reveals their significance unto the very people for whom they were originally and especially designed. Thus, by the former thing, the world of yesterday, the great and only such typologist, has projected the latter end of them, the world of today. At the outset of this typology, it is seen that the woman Eve, who through her own seed, the living church, is to bruise the serpent's head, Genesis 3:15, typifies the church preceding the Hebrew dispensation. Next, that Hagar typifies the church during the Hebrew dispensation, and finally that Sarah typifies the Christian church. Following these, the typology shows that Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High Yahweh, who has neither beginning nor end of days, typifies Asur, our high priest, and his eternal work, and that Aaron, a high priest, in the Jewish dispensation, typifies Asur, our high priest, and his temporary priestly work. While constructing the typology, Providence brought Hagar into the home of the Abraham, and through Sarah's unbearable waiting for a son, brought Ishmael into being. Thus was the forecast, the moral character, and or thus was forecast, the moral character and behavior of an antitypical nation. This is your Arab nation today. That's what that represented. Hagar and her son Ishmael represented the Muslim, the Arabs as we know them today. The Quran, keep that in mind. They represent that. They don't represent the Bible. They're not a typology of the Bible as we know it today, the King James Bible. They're a typology of the Quran, the Bible for the Muslim. Keep that in mind. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid and the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by the promise. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, who generates unto bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth unto Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, rejoice, thou barren that bearest not, break forth and cry, thou that travailest not. For the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of the promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what saith the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Galatians 4:22-31. Here it is that Hagar and Ishmael's coming into the household of Abraham foreshadowed a flesh-born, not spirit-born people, the descendants of Jacob, ancient Israel, coming into the household of Yahweh. Okay, now do you get this? Clear it is that Hagar and Ishmael coming into the household of Abraham foreshadowed a flesh-born, not spirit-born people, the descendants of Jacob, ancient Israel, coming into the household of Yahweh, not through the spiritual birth, but through the natural cause. It is also known that the Hagar's rebellion against Sarah forespoke the rebellion of the rabbis against the disciples, the apostolic congregation at the cross, and that what we know as the kingdom of grace set up by Yahshua with his apostle. Persecution of Isaac pointed out the Jews' persecution of the Christian. And last, Abraham's disinheriting Hagar and her son, sending them away once and forever, was a preview of the Yahweh's disinheriting and discharging from his household the carnal-minded Jew who failed to become converted, reconciled, born again, failed to bury the carnal mind and to rise with the spiritual one according unto the promise. Never, therefore, will the carnal Jew any more than the carnal Gentile ever with the saints inherit the kingdom of Yahweh. No more than Ishmael inherited Abraham's wealth, nor ever have any part in his glorious promises, except they be born again, born of the Spirit, into the holy family of Yahweh, Romans 11:27. Having glanced through these three church periods with their varied priesthoods, we now come to the second phase of the typology, and this we shall quickly and even more realistically see as we now review the typological drama of the ages with the aid of the accompanying chart, which graphically unveils the advancing truth and urges our compliance with the truth. By the means of this chart, which you can't see, but I can tell it to you, the Church of Yahweh is quickly seen in five different categories by the periods. The first two are within the typical, and the last three is within the antitypical. So the first two are with the typical, that's before the cross, projecting prophecy and an allegory for the time that we're living in these latter days now. Number one, the Noahic. Number two, the patriarchal. Number three, the kingdom temporal. Number four, the evangelical. Number five, the kingdom eternal. The typological seed of the woman is born in the two typical periods, the Noahic and the patriarchal, and reaches spiritual maturity during the ensuing three antitypical periods, namely the kingdom temporal and the evangelical and the kingdom eternal. Now we have three kingdoms here set up this side of the cross. The kingdom temporal was the disciples. They had set up the kingdom, Yahshua set the kingdom temporal up with them. Okay. Then you have the kingdom evangelical, as mentioned here. And that was after the temporal kingdom came to an end. And the temporal kingdom came to an end in 538 A.D. And that ushered in the evangelical kingdom of the Catholic Church being in charge of it. 538 to 1798, a 1260-year period there, prophesied in Daniel 7:25 and other places, about the 42 months, the day for a year, 3.5 years, 42 months equals 1260 days, 1260 days, a day for a year, Ezekiel 4:6 or 4:9, day for a year, 1260 years. 1798 is the ending of the 1260-year prophecy for the Dark Ages that the Catholic Church were in charge of. That was your evangelical kingdom. Your evangelical kingdom had a run of starting in 538 A.D. headed by the Catholic Church. It had the prophetic run of a 1260-year prophecy from 538 to 1798. But its influence is still felt to this very day. Since 1798, we've had 218 years. Okay, since 1798, and that's actually can be termed as the evangelical kingdom continued on, because they fell away in 1798, but then they had a revival. That's the Catholic Church, and that's the mortal wound on that beast that was inflicted on the Catholic Church by Martin Luther during the Dark Ages in 1500 A.D. That mortal wound was healed. So that healed the evangelicals. I haven't ever seen this before, but the Catholic Church are the authors of the false doctrines that we embrace, that is embraced today. Once saved, always saved. The Trinity, the three-in-one doctrine of the Trinity, which the Bible don't support, and the beat goes on. So they're the authors of the evangelical identity. And the evangelical identity also has another title, Christian. That belongs to the evangelical identity. That belongs to the amalgamation of all what we call Protestant churches today and all of their offshoots. Now, when I say offshoots of the Protestant churches, your true Protestant churches was the Lutherans. There's four of them. Only four true Protestant churches as far as that are still in existence today. Well, I say four. No, there were six. Six Protestant churches. Starting with Martin Luther. The Lutheran Church, 1500. John Knox, 1543, the Presbyterian Church. 1725, John Wesley, the Methodist Church. 1810, Alexander Campbell, the Christian, or your Baptist Church. And then in 1833, William Miller, the Prophetic Church, the Millerite movement. And 1844, the Prophetic movement of the Seventh-day Adventists. But they were all considered protest churches, Protestants. But they all have apostatized, all of them. All six of those churches I just named to you have apostatized. Those Protestant churches. And that was, now what did I say now? The Lutheran, the Presbyterian, the Methodist, the Baptist, the Millerites, and the Seventh-day Adventists. Those six have come and gone and apostatized. And they're classified as evangelical today. They all have embraced the unclean spirit of the speaking in tongues, all of them, including the Adventists. They've all embraced it. They've all embraced all the Catholic doctrines that the Catholic doctrine invented, like I said, including the Trinity. So, there you have it. You have evangelical Christians. That's what we call them. Adventists, Catholics, all amalgamated together into one quagmire of a slime pit, and they're called Mystery Babylon. This is what's called Mystery Babylon. We're getting more of an identity now of why Revelation 17 calls this woman Mystery Babylon. This is that unclean church represented by Satan, and what makes her a Mystery Babylon? She's an amalgamation of all the so-called Christian churches. Now keep in mind, when Babylon was born in the type back there with Nebuchadnezzar as the first king, she was not identified or labeled as a religious organization. Was not at all. They were atheist infidels, is what they were. But this Babylon today is made up of all these various Christian evangelical churches. They believe in the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit in one way or another. If they believe that, even if they believe that all three of them is just one, they still believe in that concept of the supernatural creator, our Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. They believe in that. The evangelical Christians believe that. But that's what makes a mystery Babylon. All of a sudden, Babylon is no longer identified as an atheist infidel. And when did she lose that identity? When did they lose that identity as an atheist infidel? When the Roman Church, after the cross, infiltrated the temporal kingdom of the disciples and appeared to be converted to a religion for the first time in their history, which the Roman Church at the cross was an extension of the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar, only called by another name. And they were pagan, atheistic heathen. But whenever they figured out a scheme how to conquer the Christians or the apostolic movement of the Nazarene, the apostles, and the Gentiles, the Jonah, when the pagan Rome figured out how to conquer them, that is, go and pretend that you won't accept their religion and join them. In other words, accept the religion for the first time in their existence. And what did they do? They went and said, well, we believe in your Messiah too, just like you do. We've accepted him. Matter of fact, we'll make a crucifix and we'll make a mold of him and we'll put him on this crucifix and hang around our neck to show your proof that we'll advertise your Messiah, that we believe in him. So the apostolic people fell for it. The apostolic, what we call Christians today, they fell for it. And they let the church join them. And what did Rome do? They went in and joined them, and then they took over their leadership, and then they forced the Christians to gradually give up their Sabbath and gradually give up all of the teachings of the law of Moses. And then they forced them into and then Constantine came along as the first pope for the Catholic Church, and he changed the Sabbath law from Sabbath to Sunday, and then eventually, during the Dark Ages, forced everybody to bow down to the Catholic Creed and to denounce the Sabbath. So now Rome has taken on an aura of Christianity. So that's when Mystery Babylon converted. She converted from atheistic heathen devils to Bible-thumping Christian believing in their God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. So that Mystery Babylon then started developing with the Catholic Church. And when did it start developing? 321 A.D., the Council of Nicaea, Constantine at Constantinople, when he had that meeting and changed with his people from all over the world and changed the seventh day to the first day of the week. And there you had it. You had evangelical Christians. Mystery Babylon was born. And we have them today. When you go to these Pentecostal churches and you see them speaking in tongues and all that false gibberish and all that false spirit, and the whole evangelical world has embraced it. Yahweh did raise up, though, Christian believing people, Protestant Sunday keepers, famous people that kept the basic fundamental doctrines of the Baptists going, and kept the good old Christian hymns going, didn't convert to this here watered down version of religious music or religion. And so you have the fundamental Baptist churches today that are actually still carrying the torch for the Protestant Reformation that Martin Luther started in 1500 A.D. Okay, having said all of that, let's continue on now with our study. We're on page 62 of the Shepherd Rod Tract. Brother V.T. Hardoff, he said, for the typological seed of the woman is born in the two typical periods, the Noetic and the Patriarchal, and reaches the spiritual maturity during the ensuing three antitypical periods, namely the Kingdom Temporal, that was from 27 A.D., when Yeshua turned 30 years old and went out and started his ministry and chose the 12 apostles to be his ministers to help him to set up the temporal kingdom of grace in 27 A.D. And that temporal kingdom lasted until 538 A.D. So figure that one out for the year's sake and see how many years that is. But you'll probably find it's about 500 years that the temporal kingdom stood. And then you had the evangelical kingdom that was born. And when was it born? The evangelical kingdom was also born in 27 A.D. And that was your Pharisees with your 613 added rules and regulations they wrote up and added to the law of Moses. And Yahshua taught from the law of Moses. And the Pharisees drew up 613 more new laws and commandments to add to the law of Moses, which Yahweh says, if any man adds to or take from what's already been written in my word, I will take his name out of the Lamb's Book of Life. Well, the Pharisees, just that's exactly what they promptly did. So, in 27 A.D., when Yahshua started his ministry, what was the first thing he did? He went up there on the hilltop where the temple stood, and he walked in there, and he started turning over the tables of the money changers. That was your evangelicals, that was your Pharisees, Sadducees, in charge of the temple, with their 613 laws that they had written and made up. In other words, they wrote their own constitution, they wrote their own laws of the kingdom. And they counterfeited the law of Moses. And they were in there then practicing a counterfeit form of worship. And that's what the money changers was all about. They were selling donaties. In other words, they were selling indulgences. They said, look, we know you can't overcome sin, but we know that you can buy you an animal. And you can cut his throat and get his blood, and you can let it stand in the place of your sin every time you come here to the temple. And so the people, they weren't taught the true plan of salvation, how they could overcome sin and stop having to sacrifice animals, because Samuel, there in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22 and 23, he told King Saul, he said, it's better to obey than sacrifice and to hearken to the fat of rams. He said, if you would be obedient, you wouldn't have to offer up animal sacrifices. Okay, so now, here we go. And then the evangelical kingdom, it started up right alongside. Well, now, let's just back up. Let's back up to the Garden of Eden. As soon as Adam and Eve sinned and fell into sin, you had the two kingdoms set up. Yahweh with his Son came into the Garden of Eden the day that Adam and Eve sinned, and they drove them out of the garden, and they made them coats of skin from some animals that they had to slay, and they took the coats of the skin of the animals, and they wrapped them about around Adam and Eve for clothing, and then they gave them the carcass of that animal to shed. And the shed blood of that animal was used for the offering up a sacrifice for Adam and Eve's sin that they had sinned in the Garden of Eden. So the first parents, their first sin had to be atoned for by an animal sacrifice outside the Garden of Eden the very day that they sinned. So how important is it for the plan of the salvation to be put into operation? Okay, let's continue on here now. So, we have the plan of salvation then was put into operation. And you had the two kingdoms then set up, running side by side. Satan already set his kingdom up whenever he deceived Adam and Eve into eating of the tree of life of good and evil. Whenever he tricked them into that, committing that sin and they fell, then that was the beginning of your two kingdoms in competition with each other, clear on down to this very day. So, in order to defeat this kingdom of Satan, Yahweh's people are going to have to be restored back to the original Garden of Eden status like Adam and Eve had to be restored on day one. So, we're going to start a series of restoration back to the Garden of Eden. I guess is what we're going to have to entitle it from here. And it's going to be an ongoing project from here on in. Okay, let us continue on here. It says, "For in the typical are the natural born children, Cain and Abel, Ishmael and Isaac, Esau and Jacob, a good and a bad in each instance. And in the antitypical, they find their antitypes as follows. Allegorically, throughout church history, are seen on the one hand Canaanites, those who are worshiping Elohim, not as he commands, but as the desire and convenience demands. And on the other hand are seen Abelites, those who are worshiping Elohim precisely according unto his will, and who moreover, for thus doing, incur the displeasure of the Canaanites, who in the anger and jealousy slay them. Thus the martyrs. Then mercy brought forth Seth to carry on the part which Abel was circumstantially forced to leave. Cain, the firstborn, represents, according unto the Bible order, a class of ministry, while the Abel and Seth, the younger, necessarily represent a class of the laity. Thus, were ministry and laity, hypocrite, martyr, and saint typed in the very beginning of the human race. Isaac, the firstborn son through promise, through the will of Yahweh, can only represent a class of ministers who are placed in that holy office through the promised spiritual birthright, born again, divinely appointed. You have to be born again, or you're of the opposing side, the adversarial side. As an adversary, you join Satan's church, and you become an evangelical, filled with an unclean spirit and a false religion. And that religion is your Koran religion. That's what they call a nondescript. You can't identify what they really stand for. All right. Ishmael, too, being Abraham's firstborn son, but not through the legal marriage or promise, he circumstantially represents a class of carnal ministry who are led unto that office not through the spiritual birthright and a call from the Yeshua of the vineyard, but only through favorable opportunity. In this manner was dramatized the character of the self-willed Jewish rabbis, the Ishmaelites and Anatot, who persecuted the apostles, the Isaacites and Anatot. Okay, so your Ishmaelites, remember when we say Ishmaelites, we're saying fleshly born. These are Quran. We're going to put Quran, their Bible, as opposed to the spirit-born Isaacites that has the Bible, King James Bible, the King James Bible. So it's the Quran versus the King James Bible today. Okay, it says Esau and Jacob being twins, and the last in this line of the typology, they therefore foreshadow two classes of people living at the same time in the congregation of Israel, period subsequent unto the one which Isaac represents, the last, the letter sin. Esau, being the firstborn, prefigures an Esauite ministry, who for as little as a mess of pottage forfeits their position unto the Jacobite laity. Jacobite laity represents the King James Bible, or uses the King James Bible as their sword, as their authority, and the Esauites, they use the same Bible, but they water it down, neutralize it, weaken it, and consequently, it has no power or influence to affect their understanding or their wisdom. They have no wisdom. They have no understanding. They don't have any of that. Because they have clung to the flesh, the carnal nature, which is what the Paul calls the law of the flesh. And they have clung to that instead of taking hold of the law of the Spirit of life in Yahshua, Romans 8:2. They've held on to the law of the flesh, and so consequently the inspired word don't make an impression upon their mind because their mind is carnal. It's fleshly. And, but Yahweh's true word is spiritual. And the carnal cannot understand it, neither indeed will they ever be able to understand it. So as we go on, it says, and in amplification of the subject, the spirit of prophecy long ago emphatically forewarned the Esau's sin. In the mighty sifting soon to take place, we shall be better able to measure the strength of Israel. For the signs reveal that the time is near when the Yahweh will manifest that his fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor. Those who have rendered supreme homage unto the science falsely so called will not be the leaders then. Those who have trusted unto the intellect, genius, or talent will not then stand at the head of the rank and file. They did not keep pace with the light. No, folks. This is what Proverbs 4:8 says, or is it 4:18? For the path of the just is as a shining light that shineth more and more to the perfect day. It's a pathway that you're on, that you're traveling along. And what happens if you stop traveling on that pathway? Well, the light moves on, and so you're left in darkness if you don't continue on walking in the light that shines upon your pathway, but then you're left in total darkness. Those who have proved themselves unfaithful will not then be entrusted with the flock. In the last solemn work, few great men will be engaged. They are self-sufficient, independent of Yahweh, and he cannot save them, use them. For the Yahweh has faithful servants who in the shaking testing time will be disclosed unto you. Testimonies, Volume 5, page 80. Now, the change of Esau's name shows that the Esauites are someday and not far hence no longer to be thought of and idolized as Esauites, as the ones who finish, but rather dreaded as Edomites, as ones who perish. And the change of the Jacob's name shows that the Jacobites are then no longer to be driven out and feared as Jacobites, as the planters, carnal, but rather welcomed as Israelites, holy princesses, co-rulers standing with the Lamb on the Mount Zion, Revelation 14:1, in the palace of the great king. Then, when the gospel work is finished and the seed of the woman mature unto the full-grown Christian, become the Yahweh's battle axe, Jeremiah 51:20, and bruise the serpent's head, also smite the wicked nations, Daniel 2:44-45, then shall be plainly seen that which the first Adam lost through indulgence, the second Adam, through self-control, recovered the kingdom eternal, again ruling the whole earth, Daniel 2:35. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, declares inspiration, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. For the Savior of the house of Jesse, the royal house of David, now keep in mind that Jesse, the father of David, represented a royal family. So King Jesse, father Jesse of David, he had 8 sons and a daughter. His 8th son was David, and David today, his descendant in his line, Yahshua, came through that line, and is recognized as the royal house of David. So Jesse is the father of the royal house of David. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with the righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. For the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall be lied down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed. Their young ones shall lie down together. And the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the winged child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth of the Yahweh, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Yahweh, as the waters cover the sea, Isaiah 11:1-9. And now, dear reader, realizing that the time for a real feast of the spiritual food meat in the due season is actually here. You are led for the inquiring of what brought it, what made the great change. For the answer unto this pertinent question is given in the following chronological coincidences. Now, the sojourn of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years, Exodus 12:40. For the reader will herein quickly see that the events during this period of the sojourning and affliction of the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Israel most remarkably coincide with a similar event in the period from the Reformation by the Luther in 1500 until the message of today, with the sealing of the 144,000. For the period of the 430 years dates from the promise given unto Abraham when he was commanded to leave Ur of the Chaldees, for the 400 years of Genesis 15:13 dates from a later period. Notice that the period of the 400 years is not only a time of sojourning, but of affliction. This, according unto the scriptures, must be reckoned from 30 years later, about the time when Ishmael, he that was born after flesh, persecuted him, Isaac, that was born after the Spirit. So you had that period in our time, coincided with Martin Luther and his exit out of the Catholic Church in 1500 to 1530 when he, I believe, posted the 95 Theses upon the door at Wittenberg, condemning the Catholic Church. Okay, and according unto Galatians 3:15, 17, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 760, and according unto Galatians 3:15-17, the 430 years ended with the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Okay, now that's interesting. The 430 years ended when they got out of Egypt to Mount Sinai. Okay, at the outset of these coincidences, we are reminded that when Abraham decided to follow the Lamb, out, or the Yeshua, out of, or follow the Yahweh, out of Ur, idolatry prevailed throughout the Chaldean world. Likewise, it held by the Protestant world that at the time Martin Luther decided to be a priest rather than a lawyer, idolatry against which he protested prevailed even throughout the apostolic world, and the doctrine which he preached being the same as Abraham's, the just shall live by faith. It is already seen that Abraham and the world in his time found their counterparts in Luther and the world in his time. Then too, Sarah and Isaac protest against Hagar and Ishmael in the end of the 30 years from the time Abraham went out of Ur, finds his counterpart in 1530 A.D., leading into this year, 1500, Luther discovered a Latin Bible in the library of the University of Erfurt and learned to his no small delight that it contained more than the excerpts in common use. His 30 years of studying and preaching the Bible resulted in the Augsburg Confession, a document adopted as the Protestant Creed and presented at the Diet of Augsburg unto the Emperor Charles V in 1530. Thus Abraham's decision to live for Yahweh instead of for coincides with Luther's decision to become a priest instead of a lawyer, and the protest of Sarah and Isaac that Hagar and Ishmael were not loyal unto Abraham's household and that they therefore were never again to be a part of it, never to be his heirs, coincides with the Protestant protest contained in the document by which they protested that the practices of the Church and of her followers in the Middle Ages were not according unto the Word. And from the time Sarah protested unto the time Moses was born, the hope of Israel's deliverance, it was 320 years, which, if added to 1530 A.D., gave 1850 the year which gave birth unto the first testimony for the Church, addressed to the 144,000 Israel of the day. Plain it is, therefore, that the birth of the Moses, the hope of the ancient Israel, finds its counterpart in the birth of the first testimony, the hope of modern Israel, continuing with these corresponding events. We call to mind that Moses at the age of 40 attempted to deliver Israel, but failing, he ran away, adding these 40 years to 1850 A.D., we arrive at 1890. The time at the Seventh-day Adventist denomination organized the National Religious Liberty Association that likewise failed to fulfill its purpose. Moreover, this notable date, 1890, was reached just 2 years after the doctrine of righteousness by the faith of the Jones and Wagner, two Adventist ministers that had prepared their documents while they were Adventist ministers in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, was first brought to the attention of the denomination at the historical 1888 Minneapolis camp meeting, and then and there rejected by nearly all of those who were present. Then during the ensuing 2 years, it was rejected by the whole denomination. See, Yeshua our righteousness. Now, when we say the whole denomination, we're talking about all of those that had joined the side of the General Conference leadership, the Jesuit president and officers that took over the Adventist Church from Ellen G. White. That's what we're talking about, the whole denomination of those that had rejected the truth. Now, the whole denomination did not reject Ellen G. White. Those that did, though, is called the whole denomination of the grizzled horse leadership of that chariot found in Zechariah 6, a double span of horses that's pulling that fourth chariot in Zechariah 6. You go read it, I think it's verse 3, where it says the bay and the grizzle. Well, the General Conference represented that lead team, the grizzled horses, that had control of the bay horses that was connected behind them, but yet their bay horses were connected directly to the chariot, which represented Ellen G. White. She was represented by the bay horses. The General Conference and those Jesuit infiltrator leaders was represented by the grizzled horses, just like those pale horse at the cross represented the Roman, pagan Roman at the cross. The fourth horse of the apocalypse, the pale horse, represented pagan Rome at the cross, nondescript, in other words. The grizzled horse is Zechariah 6, the leadership of the Adventist Church, the General Conference, nondescript in their religion. They don't, you don't know what they teach or believe. Okay, pagan Rome the same way. They did, and that fourth beast in Daniel's vision is the same thing as that pale horse, the fourth horse of the apocalypse found in Revelation 4. That nondescript fourth beast in Daniel's vision that he was told to Nebuchadnezzar, he said that fourth beast represents pagan Rome, the king of the north. Believe it or not, that's the king of the north, pagan Rome. Pagan Rome is still king of the north today in the form of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Okay? See, Yeshua, our righteousness. Okay, page 41 to 45. Okay, testimony to ministers, page 7980. This is one of the reasons that the church was in 1895 left to enter a 40-year atypical wilderness wandering. And Taylor G. Bunch wrote from 1890 to 1930, 40 years in the wilderness, matching Moses' attempt and failure to deliver ancient Israel. Also his running away into the wilderness. See 40 years in the wilderness by the elder Taylor Bunch, page 15 to 17. 40 years after his first attempt to deliver the children of Israel, Moses was finally sent back into Egypt and was then enabled to break the Egyptian yoke. Adding these 40 years to 1890 AD, we are brought to 1930, the year in which the Shepherd's Rod, Volume 1, was first published, declaring throughout the Seventh-day Adventist denomination that the year of my redeem is come, the year of the day in which the Yahweh shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, Isaiah 63:4 and 11:11. So Moses called to actually deliver Israel from the Egyptian servitude coincides with the arrival of the Shepherd's Rod demanding obedience unto Yahweh's law, declaring the truth of the 144,000 and announcing that this is the time for the deliverance from the Gentile rule. Further, from the time of Abraham's decision to follow the Yeshua unto the birth of Jacob, there were 85 years. And from the commencement of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, from its founders first translation, vision, which was regarding of the 144,000 unto the birth of the shepherd brought message, there were also 85 years. All these coincidences as to time and objective may now be quickly and more easily comprehended in the summary for the Abraham's decision to serve the Yahweh in 2083 A.M., years from creation, coincides with Luther's turning from secular to spiritual pursuits in 1500 A.D., Sarah's protest against Hagar and Ishmael in 2113 A.M., that was after the creation, coincides with Protestant's protest against the church in 1530 A.M., or A.D., 1530 A.D., by Martin Luther, Catholic Church, the birth of Moses, the hope of ancient Israel, in 2433 A.M., coincides in 1850 A.D. with the birth of the first testimonies, the hope of modern Israel, addressed to the 144,000, the Israel of today. And Moses' attempt and failure to deliver Israel in 2473 A.M. coincides with the attempt and failure of the Seventh-day Adventist Religious Liberty Association and their rejection of the message of the righteousness by faith, causing the denomination 1890 A.D. also to enter into a 40-year wilderness wonderment, so to speak. Finally, Moses' arrival in Egypt and his success in freeing the Hebrew host and restoring order and religious liberty in 2513 A.M. coincides with the arrival of the shepherd rod in 1930 A.D. and with his endeavor to effect revival and reformation and to free Israel of today. In some instances, the coincidental events may, according unto our present calendar, appear to be a year ahead or a year behind, due unto the fact that the first month of the Moses' calendar falls in the fourth month of the present calendar year. For an example, see the answer book number 34950. Okay. Hence, anyone can see that the 430 typical years and their interwoven events, from the time Abraham went out of Ur unto the time Moses with the Yahweh's rod went out of Egypt and delivered the law at the Mount Sinai, matched the 430 antitypical years from the time Luther discontinued his study of the law and began to study the Bible unto the year in which the shepherd rod proclaimed the sealing of the 144,000, the deliverance of modern Israel. These dovetailing events are now geographically and even more realistically seen in the following chart. And this brings the close of our study. This audio contact says it's the 11th hour call. And that's number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close now with a song. This brings the close of our study. This hour contact says it's the 11th hour call. And number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close now with a song entitled Till the Storm Passes By.
In the dark of the midnight have I oft hid my face, for the storms fell above me and there's no hiding place. Near the crash of the thunder, precious Yah, hear my cry. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. Till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more, till the clouds roll forever from the sky. Hold me fast, let me stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. Many times Satan whispered, there is no used to try. For there's no end of sorrow, there's no hope by and by. But I know thou art with me, and tomorrow light cast on never darkened the sky. Till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more, till the clouds are forever from the sky. Hold me fast, let me stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. And the long night has ended, and the storms have come no more. Let me stand in thy presence on that bright, peaceful shore, in that land where the tempest never comes. Yah may hide, dwell with thee till the storm passes by. Till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more, till the clouds are all forever from the sky. Hold me fast, let me stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep me safe till the storm passes by.